I'm Debbie Dashinger. Welcome to Dare to Dream. Be inspired to live big and bold and take action to turn your dreams into your reality. Go beyond obstacles and limits of your thinking. Accelerate results to catapult yourself to success. I'm a visibility expert who gives media makeovers to clients, booking them on media interviews and turning their books into international bestsellers with guaranteed results. Join me at DebbieDashinger.com. Dare to do great things. Dare to shine. It's all about you becoming a visionary and leading the pack. Welcome to your daring new life.
Welcome back to Dare to Dream. This is Debbie Dashinger. I'm so excited to welcome Joan and Ann Watts to the show. Joan grew up in the U.S. and England and studied Japanese ink painting in Japan, and her art has won awards in juried shows and hangs in many private collections. And in addition to her art career, Joan spent 25 years as a successful fundraiser in the nonprofit world. She retired in her 50s. She moved to beautiful Montana, where for 20 years she was an occasional fishing guide and operated a bed and breakfast that catered to fly fishers from around the world. Most of her life decisions have been influenced by her father, Alan Watts. Her sister, Anne Watts, is also here. Her philosophies were also strongly shaped by her experience as a daughter of Alan Watts. Anne is a certified hypnotherapist and an educator and counselor in the areas of human sexuality, sexual abuse, family stress, self-esteem, healing the inner child, and financial and aging issues. And since 1985, Anne has facilitated work she's deeply passionate about through hundreds of workshops all around the world with the Human Awareness Institute. She's also a regular faculty member at Esalen Institute. You can find Anne's work online at annewatts.com. Anne, Joan, welcome to Dare to Dream. It's terrific to have you today.
Thank you very much for having us.
I'm looking forward to talking about your new book, The Collected Letters of Alan Watts. Fascinating, really. And Joan and Anne, it seems unthinkable that somebody might not know your famous father. But for argument's sake, let's just say that there are millennials listening to the show and they have no context for the name Alan Watts. How do you describe who your father was?
Well, interestingly, there are a lot of millennials that are finding him on YouTube, his lectures and so on. And it's amazing finding young people who have come up to me and said, "Oh, your father has touched my life. I started reading his books when I was 12 years old." That's, to me, just amazing when somebody will say that. I think it's important that these young people do start viewing him and reading his work, simply because of the times we're in, which regrettably somewhat reflect the times he was in back 50 years ago. So It's kind of interesting to see such discussions coming around again, like the legalization of marijuana and political things and so on. So, Anne, do you want to add to that?
I think one way that I often describe him is that his work was bringing Asian philosophy and religion to the Western mind, to the Western thinking, in a way that people could really get it and understand it well enough to have a good grasp of it. And as Joan said, it's the resurgence of popularity in his work is extraordinary. The people from all over the world and all ages are finding it really just what they need right now. And and we're hearing from people and just loving it. So, that's kind of how I would describe him.
Great. So your dad lived from 1915 to 1973. He was British-born, known as an American philosopher, writer, speaker, counterculture hero, which word I love. And he was really known as an interpreter of Asian philosophies for the Western audience. He wrote a lot of books, if people don't know. There's much more than YouTube. There's over 25 books and numerous articles applying these teachings of Eastern religion and philosophy to help us Westerners comprehend and apply it to our everyday lives. So we know him in that context. And of course, you do a little bit in that way, but also he's familiar to you, your dad. So what kind of dad was he? Good dad, bad dad? What was the experience like having Alan Watts as a father?
For me, I had a different experience in some ways than Joan did, because I was born 4 years later than she was, and while she was born when our parents were really just madly in love with each other, by the time I came along, the bloom had worn off, and they were not so happy with each other. So first of all, I was not a wanted child, and then I experienced a lot of my mother taking her unhappiness out on me. And as far as how Alan was, when he was around, he was a pure delight to be with. I absolutely loved being with him. I felt loved, cared for, wanted by him. He would play. He would draw with us. He, you know, encouraged us in our full expression. He loved to sing. He loved to dance. Those were things that I just loved being around him. And the other side of it was that he was an absentee father a lot of the time. And so, you know, he was gone. He was either writing, and he was completely absorbed in that, or he was gone on tours or doing whatever he was doing. He just wasn't home. And just finally, I'd say the thing that I feel sad about is that he knew how I was being treated, and he never was an advocate for me. But I had a great relationship with him most of my life.
Powerful. And how about you? It sounds conversely, the other sister, completely different experience.
Yes, very much so. As one would read in the, especially his early letters, he spent a lot of time talking about me and my development and so on, and almost to the point that I felt embarrassed with my sister as we went through his letters, deciding which ones we would publish and so on. And so, you know, that was, you know, I had no idea that he treasured me like he did, apparently. And that was, you know, I saw a lot of him until our parents divorced, and then I was summarily sent off to boarding school. And so for the next 10 years probably of my life, I saw very little of him, just on vacations and so on. From there I proceeded to live in Japan, and I got married, and lived in the Midwest while he was living in California. And so the only times that I really saw him was when I could get him to come visit, usually by setting up a lecture appointments for him or something of that nature. I think, looked upon me a little bit differently at that point than he did Anne. Anne was around him and led a somewhat bohemian lifestyle. and I had married into the corporate world, and was the hostess with the mostest, doing dinner parties and so on for corporate people and that kind of thing. So he felt that I was still obviously kind of on the edge of all that. I think he didn't understand it as well as he understood Anne's lifestyle.
And so, Anne, how did you guys, women, how did you discover the letters? How did these letters become the premise of the book that you've helped to edit? And what was the process that led you to finding these letters?
Well, this is the question that I most often give over to Joan, because she was the one that was around at the time when our stepmother died, and we inherited all these letters. So I'll turn it over to Joan to continue that response.
Okay, well, so our stepmother, Alan's widow, and his third wife, died in 1994, some 20 years after he had died. And we ended up with the copyright to most of his literary books that had been published by the time he died, and also the letters and papers and so on that had been held by the widow for so many years. And it came kind of as quite a mess. The files had been damaged and by floodwaters in a storage place and so on, and so I had to hire somebody to help us go through and kind of sort out what was still readable and what wasn't and what was important to keep and so on. And then I moved to Montana, and they sat in two big legal file drawers until I retired from doing my bed and breakfast for fly fishermen and all of that in 2015, I guess it was. And I started looking at things. I mean, I'd noticed occasionally when I'd have to go in to find something for a publisher or, tax reasons or whatever. I would read letters occasionally. And one file I opened one time was filed with Timothy Leary, correspondence with Timothy Leary. And we, of course, were also involved with New World Library because they were republishing some of his out-of-print books and doing a really nice job of it. And we were meeting with him about a book that was about to come out, and I mentioned that we had letters, and the executive editor there kind of jumped on that and said, well, we really ought to look at that, and maybe we should publish them. And we said we thought that was a great idea. And so 2.5 years later, we presented him with a manuscript double the size that we signed a contract for. he said, well, we might have to cut some of this out. And we said, well, good luck. Mm-hmm. And I think we cut out three letters.
Wow.
And so we went ahead and published that book that weighs 2.5 pounds and has some 600 pages in it. So that was how that came about. And it was fairly arduous because he wrote a lot of letters, and in his day he typed mostly, and he made carbon copies of most of his letters, with the exception of the letters to his parents, which he didn't make carbon copies of, but which his parents saved every letter he wrote from the time he went away to school until I think it was about 1968. He was working on his autobiography, and I think that my grandfather sent the letters to him for a reference so he could write that. And then after 68, we don't have copies of his correspondence with his father, who actually died a year after he did. So But that's how that came about. It was quite an experience reading all those letters and going through all that. And, of course, they all had to be transcribed into Word documents. We had to scan everything and, you know, then edit them and so on. So.
I think it's amazing. I've got the book in front of me, to have such an intimate insight into somebody's life through what they wrote to somebody else, thinking it's private communication. And I really appreciated that aspect of this book, this, you know, unveiling, unfolding of somebody that we've heard so much about. And I'm curious, for you, did you learn anything reading these letters? Anything that was new information? Anything that was surprising for you to learn about Alan Watts, your father?
I would say, first of all, I was totally gobsmacked by his brilliance. I'd be reading these letters, and then I'd look at the date. I'd think, how old was he when he wrote this? And in his early 20s, there's a letter he wrote to Carl Jung. And he'd just been to a lecture that Carl Jung gave, and he felt that Carl was missing some information. And so he writes this very grown-up, equal letter to Carl Jung, giving him some information that he felt Carl was missing. It was astounding to read a letter like that from someone so young.
That blew me away, by the way, just a sidebar here, that at 21 years old, the chutzpah of him to write to a 61-year-old Carl Jung and just to fathom the kind of communication he was writing this letter with.
Right.
Did they have much of a relationship after that? Did that just open a big door?
Eventually, not right away, but eventually they did. And Alan went quite a few times to Carl Jung's place in Switzerland, I think it was.
Yeah, Switzerland, yes.
And gave talks there, and definitely they developed a really good relationship over the years. So, and there are, I think there are some more letters that he wrote to Carl Jung as well. But, yeah, I mean, it was just that kind of stuff really... I knew he was a brilliant man, but reading the letters gave me a whole new appreciation for that. I was struck by his kindness. Mm. He's incredibly kind in his letters. And the amount of time and thoughtfulness that he would pour out to people he hadn't even met. Who had written to ask him for help or could ask some question about something. You know, he would just really, really pour out to them and in such a kind and caring way. It was really beautiful. On a personal note, you know, I discovered that all my thoughts about my childhood and what I actually experienced were confirmed in the letters. And I have this experience that our memories don't always serve us.
Right.
And, you know, we don't remember things as accurately as we think we do. And so I've always held that, you know, what I think happened when I was a child might not exactly be what happened. But his letters exactly confirmed what I believed, and so that was an interesting experience for me on a personal note.
There's also a situation being born with the name, right? Choosing a name, not having a name, referring to the child as it.
Oh, right.
Oh, that was me, yes.
She had a name.
When I was born. Well, that was interesting because, you know, obviously both my mother and father were very young in their, my mother was 18 and my father was, 21 maybe, if that. And neither of them had brothers or sisters. And my father had been brought up by very loving parents, and my mother had been brought up by very distant parents, that she was basically raised by governesses and so on. So they came from different places into parenthood. And I'm sure suddenly finding this writhing little human being, you don't know exactly, I suppose. He had absolutely no idea how to handle a child, and they just had to learn by experience. And I thought it was kind of interesting that he was so fascinated with my development, because he'd, of course, not experienced that through a sibling or through cousins or whatever. And then choosing my name, that was of the time. And there are several instances throughout the book, the early part of the book, I should say, where because of the political climate, my name, they wanted to give me a middle name, but they couldn't settle on it because my mother's name was Ruth, and she didn't like that, and my mother's grandmother, well, let's see, it was Ellen. It was either going to be my mother's middle name, which was Eleanor, or her first name rather, or my grandmother, my father's mother's name, which was Emily, but my initials would be J-E-W, which
right.
in their consideration, unfortunate. And at that time, it was just as the Second World War was gearing up, and the Nazi regime was offing Jews everywhere, and so there was a great influx into New York City of Jews, and I guess certain classes and at that time felt that they were rather a boisterous lot, and so I think some of that my father's feelings were reflected by his mother-in-law too. Excuse me.
Well, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll be diving a bit more into the book, The Collected Letters, as well as why Alan had a predilection for this particular philosophy and religion, how it impacted his children, and much more about some fascinating commentaries. You're listening to Dare to Dream Radio. Join me after the show on Facebook at Dare to Dream Radio and TV. We'll be right back.
What is LinkedIn, and why should you be on it? Wondering what in the world people use LinkedIn for? You will be surprised how much is available on this popular business social network. Go to www.yourconnectionconsultant.com. Did you know that 64% of all social media traffic to websites is driven by LinkedIn? Rhonda Scher, known as the LinkedIn Diva, will explain how to double your business using LinkedIn. Don't be left out. Learn how to leverage LinkedIn today. Rhonda Scher, the LinkedIn expert, is your connection consultant at www.yourconnectionconsultant.com.
Tell the world about your product or business. Advertise on Dare to Dream Radio. The award-winning program is syndicated on over 60 stations, has a big following, and large listenership. If you're ready to expand your reach, become a sponsor or advertiser on Dare to Dream Radio. Best rates, great results. Email ads@debbiedashinger.com. That's ads@debbiedashinger.com.
Debbie Dashinger's Radio Interview Mastery Program is a unique branded system that works. MediaMasteryRadio.com puts you on a fast track to grow your business and easily book interviews. Learn how at MediaMasteryRadio.com. Debbie is fiercely committed to guiding entrepreneurs, authors, speakers, healers, and business people. Learn how to leverage your radio appearances to grow your business and increase your visibility at MediaMasteryRadio.com.
Listen, do you hear that? It's the sound of your life running smoothly. A big part of harmony has to do with your thoughts. Are your issues ruining your life? Debbie Dashinger is a certified BARS facilitator who uses energy clearings on clients for healing, creativity, aging, sleep, money, and more. In a BARS session, you will begin clearing away issues and allow harmony and change. Book your BARS session at www.debbiedashinger.com.
Welcome back to Dare to Dream, Debbie Dashinger, and I'm interviewing Joan and Anne Watts. Their book is called The Collected Letters of Alan Watts. Watts was one of the first to interpret Eastern wisdom for a Western audience, and the book is published by New World Library. So, Anne, Joan, in your book, The Collected Letters, it's clear, you mentioned this a little earlier, for me as a reader, very clear through Alan's letters, that by 17, there was a lot going on. Very confident. It's brazen. He leaves school. He becomes a writer and an editor for the Journal of the Buddhist Lodge. He publishes a booklet on Zen, all by 17. And from reading his letters for you editing and publishing this new book, what kind of person was Alan to be so persistent in foregoing traditional education in order to follow this path at such a young age?
Anne, do you want to take that?
Well, I'll take a stab at it. I think, you know, the fact that he was so brilliant, I think he got very bored with traditional education fairly quickly, and one of his good friends at boarding school came from a very wealthy family, and they took him to Paris when he was a teen, and you know, Aleister Crowley was the name of the father, and he treated our dad as if he were an equal, as if he were an adult, and taught him about smoking cigars and good food, and this man had in his home a library that Alan just fell in love with, and so, you know, like a lot of his preferred reading came from that library, and so he developed an early sophistication. And where he developed a taste for good food, gourmet-type food, which was a passion of his entire life. You know, I think that had a huge influence. The other thing is our grandmother, his mother, taught at a school that was for the daughters of missionaries. And the missionaries would go off to Asia and do their teaching, and they would come back and bring gifts of things like Ming vases and that kind of thing, and give them to Alan's mother. And he fell in love with those. Like, he would look at those, and the artist in him, because he was also an artist, the artist in him delighted in those drawings. And that, I think, had another influence on him about things Asian. So that's some of my thoughts about it. Maybe, Joan, how about you?
Mm. Yeah, I think, well, you know, what was evident as a young person, he was, somehow he just was brilliant. I was totally amazed at his how scholarly he was about things, and how he could absorb knowledge so easily. When he entered seminary, he learned Latin and Greek, and you know, excelled in those subjects. And he just had this thirst, brilliance of his mind. And aside from going to Europe, he was beginning to associate with people through the Buddhist Society. He was associating with people like D.T. Suzuki and a number of other religious types of people, theosophists and so on, that were involved with the Buddhist Institute or the Buddhist Society. And so he was around adults that had a great deal of knowledge and that he respected and learned from them. And then his fascination with reading. He spent a lot of time at a bookstore in London where he found books on Asia and so on that were fascinating to him. It's actually where he discovered the the Buddhist Society. There was a pamphlet stuck in one of the books. And so he immediately became a member and then presented them with his little book on Zen. And they immediately contacted him to come speak and were astonished that he was, I think he was, what, 17 years old at that time, if that. Mm-hmm. And they had expected, of course, somebody much older. You know, he just gained that kind of wisdom, and it was kind of like he was an old soul that, you know, perhaps has come back a few times, and, you know, it just mm-hmm. comes back with more knowledge every time, and there he is with this incredible thirst for knowledge. As he got older, you know, he got interested in other things and would learn about them, and I think one of the more interesting things was towards his death, he had become involved in quantum physics and was fascinated with that as it related to the universe and so on. So,
You know, Joan, there's a fascinating commentary by you that highlights and adds to the letters. And this is a quote from you, which reads, "For Alan, the use of psychedelics was a religious experience. He felt that the abuse or constant use of such drugs was to nullify the spiritual effect one could garner from the experience. It was like finding a shortcut to Satori or Samadhi, but on an entirely different wavelength. To Alan, drug-induced altered states could be compared to certain states experienced in some Buddhist and other religious practices." Talk about that. You had previously mentioned LSD, so let's go back to the psychedelics and what you know of that and how he was using that to further himself.
Well, I think I think it was around the mid-50s he started becoming involved in that through Aldous Huxley. And he basically was fascinated with how it affected the mind, and like mescaline and other substances as well. I think that he, in particular, wanted to see what it did in terms of expanding your experience of the world. And it wasn't just a party time type thing, which it eventually became, unfortunately. He did a lot of research. He made himself somewhat of a human guinea pig for Tim Leary and Richard Alpert when they were at Harvard experimenting with the drugs, and then he also assisted them in experiments they did with prisoners and so on. And it's interesting because I just read an article recently where they're again beginning to look at LSD for treatment of psychiatric patients and so on.
Yes.
Which I think is fascinating. It's like the idea has come full circle again. So... And he really wanted not to make it illegal, but to be carefully used. So.
And what kind of discoveries did he make using that? Was there anything that was really a departure from where he had been before that would created this big opening because of his experiences?
I can't come up with an answer to that immediately. I'd have to think about it.
One of the things I think that it did help him to do, I think it expanded his sense of the connectedness of all that is.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was one of the effects of it, and I think another effect of it was in lightening up. It was in that era that he was residing in California. He was making new friends through the Asian Academy of American Studies. And he was beginning to loosen up more and lighten up. And I do think that the psychedelics were a part of all of that.
Mm-hmm. And the names that have been mentioned so far and also are mentioned in the book, Timothy Leary, Joseph Campbell, Henry Miller, Gary Snyder, Aldous Huxley. What are those relationships? What is that matrix going on with Alan Watts?
Well, I think they were all kindred souls, so to speak. They all were sort of pursuing, I don't know what I would call it, higher thought or expansive thought. I think another person that would be involved in that would have been John Lilly, the man that did a lot of experiments with dolphins. They all had extreme curiosity about how the universe functioned and wanting to somehow bring an understanding of the connectedness of everything to the general population, so to speak. That's kind of my feeling about it. I don't know, Anne, do you have something to add to that?
No, I think I think you've answered it really well.
When we come back, we'll be talking about some possible misconceptions that people have had about Alan Watts and getting those straightened out, and also his philosophies and more. And if you want to be a published author, you can apply to write a chapter in the new anthology book called I Am Still Here, Turning Trials into Transformation. There are author spots, 25 of them available, and the authors will be featured in the book. You can go to debbied.net/anthology. The compilation book will receive global distribution and will be launched to guaranteed international bestseller. Again, if interested to become a published author this year, go to debbied.net/anthology. I'll be right back.
What would you say if I told you that you could change your life in only 1 hour and all while lying down relaxing? Thousands of people all over the world have. What am I talking about? It's called Access Consciousness The Bars. The Bars is an energetic body process that contains 32 different points on your head that, when run, assist you in releasing decisions about any area of your life that you have made solid and, as a result, cannot change. The Bars is the first class in Access Consciousness, a dynamic set of tools and information designed to transform any area of your life. When you have a Bars session, the worst that can happen is you feel like you had a fantastic massage. The best thing that can happen is your whole life could change. Go to accessconsciousness.com today to find a facilitator, to schedule a private session, or to find a Bars class in your area. Are you willing to give yourself an hour to change your life?
Do you have a published book that never reached its bestseller potential? Are you working on a book or ebook you hope to publish soon? Do you have a book locked inside, waiting to release your message to the world? Go to mybestsellerbook.com. My Bestseller Book will launch your book to a guaranteed bestseller status. Learn more at mybestsellerbook.com.
Are you suffering from headaches, backaches, joint or muscle pain that's hurting your work performance? Todd Nelson is a naturopath who for 36 years has helped employees, executives, and entrepreneurs alleviate the chronic pain that kills their work performance, naturally, without depending on dangerous medications. In Todd's new report, No Pain Equals More Gain, he shares 6 major steps you can take today to start reducing pain and increasing performance. You can get this free report right now by going to nopainmoregain.net. That's nopainmoregain.net. Stop letting pain get in the way of your peak performance at work. Learn how to start working and living pain-free naturally right now at nopainmoregain.net.
You've had enough of seeking for your purpose. You are ready to start living it. Right now, you only need one answer. What realizing your life's purpose will look like? How exactly will you do that? You don't want to make another mistake, change careers, only to feel trapped and bored again. You want to absolutely know what your special gift is and who you are meant to serve with your gift. Great business ideas are just that. They are aligned with your true essence and make a profound difference in somebody else's life. Get your free Activate Your Life's Purpose call with Lyra Kay, an international best-selling author, quantum success business, life coach, and your creative genius activator. Lyra Kay will help you take the next step today so you can make an impact and realize your potential now. Book your call at shesgotpassion.com.
Welcome back. I'm speaking with Joan and Ann Watts, daughters of Alan and editors of the Collected Letters of Alan Watts. I want to start with misconceptions. So Joan, maybe you want to start here. What are some misconceptions that people often have about Alan Watts that simply are not true?
That's a tough one. Now I don't know why you picked me. Did I say something in the book that would make you believe that?
I'm just always curious when someone is that in the public eye and that known for their personality, you know, and I've read transcripts of his interviews and I mean, fascinating guy. Some of his conversations about God and your God and, you know, funny and interesting and deep and all of that. But people have a tendency to put labels or ideas on someone who's famous that may not actually be accurate. So I'm curious, because you knew him intimately and then even more so through the letters, that things that people may have said to you about him or written about him or thought about him, were they true? Was there anything that's been off that, like, you've got a microphone and you can actually correct right now?
Well, I, you know, I think one of the things that that came out a fair amount was that he was a womanizer. And to some extent, that was true. But on the other hand, it was kind of laid on him in the sense that there were certain types of women that absolutely adored him and would just kind of lay themselves at his feet. And that, you know, for him, growing up, he always felt that he never got pretty girls and he was awkward around them and so on. And so, you know, as he matured, he found that he could be very charming with women, and women absolutely adored that. And I think that I felt like it wasn't entirely fair to label him that so much. You know, obviously he was married 3 times. And had a couple of mistresses, and one that we didn't even find out about until we started working on the book. With the Me Too movement now, it's really hard to quantify that or qualify it in any logical sense at this point, other than I think that most of his any of his liaisons were strictly mutual. And he wrote a bit about that in his autobiography, about how he felt about marriage, open marriage, and loving other people. To him, it wasn't something where you put a notch on your belt. It was something where you had a mutual attraction with somebody on perhaps even a philosophical level, and that it would lead to a more intimate relationship. So it's, you know, that I think that was probably one of the more scathing opinions of him that was out there. I felt like watching it, as I did very closely, because I had that opportunity, I thought differently than being a womanizer.
Yes. Alan Watts talks about Buddhism, mindfulness, meditation, and how to live a fulfilling life. Anne, what do you think stands out the most in regards to Anne's philosophies on love and life and happiness? What was something that you thought was really key?
You're saying that kind of like how were my philosophies shaped by what Alan talked about?
Well, I'm curious first about his philosophies and what you thought was key about life, love, happiness.
I think I spoke to it earlier about his belief of everything being connected. And so I think that's a big part of it. Joan was just speaking about his belief, which I think really comes from a lot of historical studies, things like Margaret Mead, who was one of his friends, studies about how people in different parts of the world, how they believed in people just loving each other and supporting each other, and people weren't put into one-on-one relationships that would last forever, supposedly. They were really, people were polyamorous, basically. And Alan was strongly attracted to that belief and felt like that was his personal philosophy. As well, and so so those were some of the things that he believed in and lived his life by.
And you brought up the idea about how things impacted you, and I would love to know, how did growing up around his thinking and teachings impact each of you?
Well, for myself, I would say that a lot of the things that he talked about, I notice now as an adult, it's as if I took them in by osmosis, and it became part of my own personal philosophy and belief system. And so I've never been a student of Zen myself, and nor have I been a student of Alan Watts in the sense that, you know, I haven't been reading all his books and, you know, following this man. But a lot of what I hear him say is like, yeah, right, that's what I think, is my experience of that. And I'm quite clear that that's from having grown up with him and been around him my whole life. And so things like that.
Mm-hmm. And Joan, I'm curious, did the book, doing this book, being engaged in this book, change your life? And if so, how?
I think it's too early to tell. I mean, it's changed my life in that I suddenly have another job. The whole thing of producing the book, a lot of that rested on me because I had the materials here. I didn't have another job that took me all over the world as my sister did. And so I sat at a computer for the good part of 2 years working on editing and writing and so on. It was a great, worthwhile experience. I was shocked that I could write the way I did, I might consider writing more eventually. I ended up being asked to write a foreword for a book about my grandmother.
Wow.
Which is an interesting book in itself because it would be a companion reader in some ways to the book about Alan's letters, because our grandmother Ruth
We may have lost her there real quick. I'm not hearing. But I want to ask you guys this, you women this, if I may, because this is something I ask all my guests, and so I ask you as well. This is Dare to Dream. You've just done this amazing and beautiful book, and now you're sharing that you're writing a next book about your grandmother. What are you next, Dare to Dream? What are your future dreams and goals that you'd like to see come to fruition? Anne, let's start with you.
My dare to dream is that people really learn to treat each other kindly and be better listeners for each other, and more open-hearted and compassionate with one another. And so the work that I do through the Human Awareness Institute, it's really very focused on that kind of thing. So it's like I devote my life to helping people to treat themselves and the people they interact with in a more loving and respectful, kind way. And so that's really my passion. Mm-hmm. And now that Joe mentioned the Me Too thing that's happening now, I feel it's really important that this is happening, that people have the conversation that gets us to change attitudes and behaviors that really pit people against each other and have people treat each other in demeaning ways. I mentioned that about my father. One of the things that I really love about him was how much he treated people kindly mm-hmm. and caringly. And so that's, you know, like all of us, I think we all have the moments when we're not living up to who we planned to be, who we believe ourselves to be. And he, like myself, there are moments when he didn't treat somebody kindly, but by and large, that's who he was, very kind, very compassionate.
Lovely.
You know.
And Joan, how about for you? We're right here at the end. What is your next dream that you'd like to create?
Given that I'm going to be 80 this year, I'm, you know, really looking at what the next 10, maybe 20 years is going to mean for me. And, you know, I face a lot of very difficult decisions at this point because I have a husband whose health is somewhat deteriorated. And, you know, you have to start making decisions about how you're going to live and where you're going to live out the balance of your life when you get to be my age. And it's a very complicated thing to do. And you have to evaluate everybody's feelings on how that should work and what you can do to accomplish the dreaded word of downsizing. And you know, what all is involved with that. So I want to continue doing some of what I've done with the book. And unfortunately, I'm not as free to travel as Anne is. She's participating in far more book events than I am. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's hard because to me it's fun and I enjoy doing that, and I wish I had more opportunity to do it.
Yes. Well, what you've put out, I will say, I hope people will find your book, The Collected Letters of Ellen Watts. I think it's an amazing contribution. And thank you for sharing what's next for you. And thank you so much, Joan and Anne, for being with us on Dare to Dream today. Really appreciate what you've done and what you've shared.
Well, thank you. We've enjoyed it.
Thanks for having us.
And I end today's show with this quote from Ellen Watts. The art of living is neither careless drifting on the one hand, nor fearful clinging to the past on the other. It consists in being sensitive to each moment, in regarding it as utterly new and unique, in having the mind open and wholly receptive. Next week on Dare to Dream Radio, I am featuring an interview with Brad and Casey Wallace, who channel the wisdom and energy called Julius. You can subscribe to my inspirational YouTube videos at youtube.com/DebOnTheRadio. And if it is your time to become a best-selling author or time to get booked on radio and get big results, just email me at bestseller@debbiedashinger.com or go to mybestsellerbook.com, get your business offerings and media appearances and book where they ought to be, bestseller status. Thank you so much for joining me on Dare to Dream today.
To contact the award-winning syndicated Dare to Dream radio show, go to debbiedashinger.com. Keep your excellent feedback and comments coming. Your host, Debbie Dashinger, is an expert at goal achievement, a media personality, an international best-selling author, and a keynote speaker. Debbie leads high-quality teleseminars on how to achieve goals, how to be a self-published best-selling author, and how to get booked on radio. All classes are at DebbieDashinger.com. Debbie's best-selling books are Dare to Dream, This Life Counts, sold on Amazon, and her second book, Wisdom to Success, The Secrets to Accomplish All Your Dreams, sold online at all bookstores. Tune in again to hear the next inspiring interview guest who has turned their vision into a successful reality. Want more support in making your dreams come true? Go to DebbieDashinger.com. That's www.DebbieDashinger.com. You'll see videos, MP3s, archived interviews, and amazing products sharing the secret steps to making your dreams come true. Remember to dream big with every expectation that your dream will become real. Dreams are free, so free your dreams. What do you dare to dream?
Here I'm standing now, waiting for my time to be yours.